Hello, and welcome back to Private Markets Made Human, the podcast from Hamilton Lane that brings information and perspective from our greatest asset, our people. I'm very excited about today's show. As many listening already know, the firm has recently undergone a leadership transition, with longtime executives Eric Hirsch and Juan Delgado stepping in as co-CEOs earlier this year. Eric first joined Hamilton Lane in 1998 after a few years in banking. He then ascended quickly at the firm, becoming the official first chief investment officer, a role he held for over 13 years. Eric then moved into the role of vice chairman, leading the firm's strategic and technology initiatives, and has also served as a member of the company's board of directors for several years. Eric was instrumental in helping to take the company public in 2017 and has been integral to many of the firm's most successful technology and data partnerships with companies such as iLevel, Cobalt, Nevada, and Tiffin, among many others. Juan Delgado joined Hamilton Lane in 2005 to further build out the firm's international presence. Prior to joining, he was an investment manager at a middle market private equity firm. And before that, Juan, who was a PhD and statistician, was teaching at Stanford University. Similar to Eric, Juan has taken on many roles internally, including building out the leadership team in EMEA, opening our first Asia offices, and eventually relocating to Hong Kong in 2011 to serve as head of APAC and head of international. Juan also previously held the title of vice chairman and likewise serves on many of the firm's investment and executive committees, and now on the firm's board of directors. It's no secret that both Eric and Juan have been long-term partners and instrumental in shaping Hamilton Lane into the firm it is today. I'm looking forward to our discussion and giving our listeners an inside look on their relationship and how they are both thinking about the strategic direction of the firm in a rapidly evolving industry. With that, let's dive into our discussion. Hello, gentlemen. Welcome to the hot seat here. It's your first time on the podcast.
Happy to be here. Doesn't feel that hot yet.
No, it's pretty cool. Thank you for having us.
Sure. Yes. It's great that we could do this together in studio. Yep. I know that you guys have had some travel recently. Can you tell us first, where have you been the last few weeks?
Where have I not been? I'll go first. I kind of had breakfast in Mexico on a Monday, stopped by Paris on the way to Tel Aviv, saw the president of a country, came here, and I'm on my way to Australia.
Via Portland,
that's right.
This is actually nice because we're rarely in the same office at the same time. Last week, I was in Europe for the week, spent a lot of time with our crew in London, saw some clients, saw some prospects, and enjoyed spending time with the team.
That's great. I feel like that's going to be the theme for many years to come. So, I'm really glad we got to do this in person, sitting around the table. This is a real honor for me. I have had the privilege to work with both of you for many years. And so we got a bunch of tough questions today, and I'm going to jump right in.
Bring it on.
So, Eric, I'll start with you. You joined the firm 25 years ago, and we were a much smaller team firm back then. We had our advisory business established. We had really just launched the separate account business. What was Hamilton Lane like when you joined, and what was sort of the industry footprint at the time?
As you said, it was small. When I joined 25 years ago, we were about 25 people. The business back then was primarily a consulting business. The industry itself was young. I mean, if you think about really when most of the activity started for both our firm and for the industry, you're sort of talking 91, 92. A lot of the franchises that we think of today as the household names were really just getting started then. And Hamilton Lane was very early in recognizing that some of the larger pools of capital, pensions, et cetera, were going to need assistance. And so that's what the business looked like then. It felt much more consultative, and we were beginning to expand a little bit outside the U.S.
That's great. And were there some key milestones or things that you've been a part of that really have been the drivers of scale here? Are there any sort of key inflection points that you were involved with?
I think there's been several. And I don't think this is a singular issue. I think this is about the firm itself has just continued to evolve. I think so many firms struggle because they remain static. And I think one of the hallmarks of this franchise has been that it has constantly challenged itself to evolve. And if you think about where we had those significant movements, I would say very, very early mover into the separate account business. When most of the industry back then was thinking nothing but fund to funds, we were thinking customized solutions for our clients and making sure that experience was better and healthier for them. That was a big inflection point. Sort of our management buyout in 2003 where we partnered with some of our current employees, with some outside parties to buy the firm back from its original founders. That was a major inflection point. One of the reasons, aside from sort of ownership change for the better, was because it introduced really an equity culture into the firm and began for the first time to put stock in the hands of a lot of the employee base and getting people focused on kind of creating value and growing. So I would say those were kind of two of the bigger inflection points.
And when did this focus on data really start to happen?
I think it was present then. I think it's always been present. The firm's always been a little nerdy. And I think that is, as king nerd or one of the king nerds, I love that.
Yes.
And so that notion of data and knowing, I think it comes from the consulting mindset. If you're in the business where people are coming to you because they want advice and perspective and because you're the expert, you need to arm yourselves with all of the information you possibly can. And so I think the firm was very quick to embrace just wanting to know more.
Yeah. We were not even 60 people. We had a head of research and a research team back 20 years ago.
So Juan, you also joined at an interesting inflection point. It was right after the management buyout.
Before Juan and after Juan.
Do we have two offices then?
As far as I'm concerned, it was, there'd been the Denver office and other precursors, but it was Philly, Balakinwood, and it was London. And it was Duke DeGrasse, Pete Larson, and nobody else. And this is a mighty Hamilton Lane, come join.
And what was your role back then?
Well, it was the actual definition was a VP of investments. We had we invested together across primary, secondaries, co-invest in Europe to fulfill the role of being able to deploy capital for our accounts in Europe, which is what I did for the most part. We had some clients in Europe already, but frankly, my partner and head of Europe at the time, Duke DeGrasse, was handling mostly clients. So it was a due diligence. You call it a due diligence job.
Eric, you were leading the team at the time. Is that how you two first came
Absolutely.
Into?
Not only that, but also people don't realize, so the first GP meetings I ever took, so I came from a GP partner, not a fund of funds. So the first time I'm kind of practicing to be an allocator and a fund of funds kind of guy, the with names like Charterhouse, Phoenix, you know, well-known names, Terra Firma back then, the last person to ever met them was Eric. Mm-hmm. Eric had flown across and run those due diligence meetings, and then along comes Juan as a new hire. So I feel very connected that way.
So you two now have been working together almost 19, 20 years. What is the communication style? How's that evolved? Obviously, a long time ago, you were doing investment diligence, but you know, now that you're co-leading the business, how do you guys communicate best together?
I think we, first of all, is we've never been together for too long in the same city, in the same place, in the same, we always had to deal with this remoteness and making sure the business worked across the time zones. And so I think Eric has a phenomenal sense of honesty and fresh, direct approach, which was completely different. It's a big contrast to what I was used to at a different firm before I joined Hamilton Lane. I found that stimulating, refreshing, intellectually honest. And then they were relatively easy, hard, and everything in between, things to talk about. And he was always there. I think also people don't realize how responsive across the time zone Eric has always been, and I think that builds obviously the experience, and you go through the motions, through the growth, through the different offices, through the issues, through the investments. So there's always a range of topics in a very fluid, honest communication, and very efficient, right? And that was before iPhones and before videos, and so it was largely voice, by the way.
I think we're two people that genuinely love what we do, and so there is no off switch. And so our ability to reach out at weird hours of the day or on weekends or interrupting each other's rhythm or lack thereof has always just been part of our rapport, and that continues to work well.
Yeah. And you guys spend some time together outside of the office too, which is nice.
For sure. We have over the years. Also, I was at a dinner yesterday, and people appreciate I had children later in life. So also at the beginning, we were both married with professional wives, no children, and Hamilton Lane was the only other thing. And we had that in common and a lot of time. There was no other considerations. And I'd say that every time I was here physically, we spent some time together.
Your baby has grown.
Yes.
the footprint today is pretty big, right? There's 700 employees, 23 offices. Eric, you spend a lot of time with the street and talking to our public market shareholders. How do you sort of describe what the platform is today?
I think we're an amazing business. If you just sort of look at it at a very macro level, we're an industry with a good tailwind. We are a market leader that has resulted in consistent double-digit growth across all metrics, revenue, earnings, et cetera. And given what we do as an asset management firm, we have the ability to be very stable with incredibly high client retention. So from an investment perspective, to find a company where you say, well, it grows double digits, it has good margins, it has an award-winning culture, it's in an industry with tailwinds, you don't find those every day. And so I think we've been very proud of the value that we have created for our shareholders. If you look at sort of where the company is versus where the company was when we went public, it has been a significant appreciation in capital value. And I think that's just reflective of the effort that this team puts in and day out.
What do you guys think has been the reaction from either the street or internally to the co-CEO announcement?
I think you have questions. Obviously, co-CEO is a specific arrangement, right? So you have to answer the why two versus one. I think that's fair. I think we've explained what we just did with you, how we've worked together. It's a true partnership that is not made by being appointed co-CEO. That predates that. But I'd say it's been very positive from investors, for our clients. We're a known entity. I mean, there's no surprise on that. And so I think it's been, for the street, I think Eric is in front of that. So I'd say, you know, we were all ready for a longer period of answering questions. And frankly, Eric and I were just getting, you know, congrats on that September day. And it's been very positive.
Yeah, that's great. I think people are excited for this, you know, renewed change, right? It's fresh perspective.
But I think there's a reason why I think a number of companies in our industry have kind of a dual leadership perspective. Mm-hmm. And some of my friends who work in more traditional manufacturing industries or something say, why do you need two of you? And I say, well, the job is complicated. And their answer is, well, you're a pretty small company, all things considered, which we are. 700 people, I think Juan and I both view this as a very small business that is sort of in the process of maturing and turning into a bigger business. Right. But I think the expectation today of an industry that requires an enormous amount of travel and a business that requires a lot of management, mm-hmm, is very difficult to kind of stretch that across single people. And so, and not to mention the 23 offices and all of the time zones and all the things that come with that. And so for a small business, we're relatively complex. And I think having the benefit of two people with different areas of focus and different skill sets and some different backgrounds that are very complementary, I think is pretty powerful.
So let's click into that for a minute. What responsibilities is each of you taking on?
So you think about sort of a top division. So Juan is largely focusing on what I would sort of think of as the revenue generating side of the business. So Juan is managing sort of all things sales and client facing. And again, that's globally. The area that we intersect on is the global investment team. We both, as you've heard, bring that investment background, and the investment team is operating on a truly global basis. So having us split geographically with me in the States and Juan in Hong Kong, super helpful. And then I'm then sort of singularly focused on more of the operating side of the business. So think about operations, finance, human resources, and trying to make sure that the firm is as well managed and well governed as possible.
So Juan, you have this sort of revenue generating hat on now. That's a big part of that is ex-US, but how are you seeing things kind of growing internationally?
I think it's both, by the way, but obviously I was hired to really help expand that globally. And I think we've done tremendously. That was, you asked about the inflection points, and I think the firm always wanted to be a global leader. If you're a specialized firm in the asset management side, you need to really be global, and we always felt that was the job. And then there was a time when it was being able to cut across all the sub-strategies within the asset class. If you put just that matrix together of geographies and sub-strategies, I think we've done a great job at making sure that we have investment teams executing all of them on a global basis and clients that like the service they get and the products we offer. But there's more to do, right? There's areas of the world where we have an amazing brand, and we win awards for being the best asset management firm, bar none. And there's other places where we are more modest. So I feel like the biggest incentive I get out of this is to even things out. We should reach the same level across our footprint. And I think we have the footprint, we have the teams, and we have this room to grow into our leading position in more and more markets.
That's great. And is Mario still involved? Are you still talking to?
Yeah.
Daily.
The guy
yeah.
every day.
Part of my, so we've been partners and have been in the same location for so long that I talk to him every day. There's both a partnership model there. There's a deep friendship, and he remains hugely involved in the business. He was 2 weeks ago in Australia doing what he loves doing, which is spending time with customers. And what he's not doing anymore are the things that he didn't love doing, which is dealing with the accountants and dealing with human resources and dealing with all the aspects of sort of running a company. So I think we have him back in his happy place. And I think we're both thrilled that he's here and continuing to contribute significantly.
So before we jump into some macro topics, you know, you guys obviously spend a majority of your time thinking about this Hamilton Lane, but there's a lot of things that you do outside of work that really contribute to all of the success that you've had here. Eric, I know you've sort of been involved in a lot of charities and student work programs. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the activities you do outside of the office?
I think you're right. I think part of being a leader is trying to build networks, both personally and professionally, because I think oftentimes those worlds intersect. And I think it's also putting you in positions where you are gaining knowledge that can be helpful to the business, and also trying to kind of lead by example of giving back. So for me, I sort of spend time with a variety of kind of youth-oriented charities, a variety of mentoring programs. I'm involved in a political think tank that I think is something that obviously very much impacts us on a regular basis. But I think all those things are both for me personally satisfying, and I think also, again, good for the business.
That's great. And Juan, you're also, you know, you're known around here as the international traveler and obviously lover of all things endurance activity. But what other things keep you busy out of the office?
What else? What do you mean? There's nothing else. It's the family, of course. But no, I think that's pretty much it. I think running does take time and it's addictive, and it's a few hours of a week. But my biggest love in that respect, where I get the comparable education and engagement that Eric refers to in his other activities, is from, frankly, it's from the clients. It's from traveling. Yeah. It's the immense luxury of you sit on a breakfast with a leading family owning multiple businesses that happens to own also a pension fund manager that is your client, and you just get educated on the state of the country, what's going to happen in the next election in Mexico. And if I like listening to people, I like talking to people, and that engagement we have with our clients makes me privilegedly informed in many cases. I was in Israel, as you all know, recently, and we had an audience with the president of the country. I mean, that's not because of I'm Juan. That's because I represent Hamilton Lane. That's what we do. But I do get the benefit of that knowledge and that perspective, and that's one of the things I try to contribute clearly.
That's great. So let's pivot back to private markets for a minute and get some perspective from you both on a few key topics that are top of mind for LPs and GPs today. Eric, I'll start with you. Big firms getting bigger. There's sort of a huge chunk of fundraising dollars that are going to these larger institutions. There's a lot of industry M&A at that big size. Is this a trend you think is going to continue?
I think not only will it continue, but I actually think it's barely started. Mm-hmm. So I think brand matters, stability matters, distribution matters. I think most LPs are looking to do more with fewer. And I think all of those should lead to an industry that frankly should be consolidating. Our industry has not consolidated, and I suspect it won't because of the mechanics of these fund structures, the egos that are involved, and the reality that often 1 + 1 may not equal 2. But I think if we're stepping back and looking at just simply the trend of will the big continue to get bigger, will they expand business lines, will they be a little bit acquisitive, I think the answer is absolutely yes. And as I said, I think we've barely begun.
And what does that mean for some of the smaller shops that don't have those capabilities?
I think it's actually more of the middle that should probably be a little bit more concerned. I think sort of small and niche-y, and if you sort of think about the public equity market, you tend to see that barbelled out. You have huge, large public equity asset management firms, and then you have very small very sort of singular focused, performance oriented, fulfilling kind of niche parts of your portfolio. And it's really the middle that I think is a question mark of what are they bringing that's either differentiated or necessary. And so I think it's probably the middle that is going to be more at risk.
And the LPGP alignment, I know we kind of go through waves with this oftentimes through cycles, but you know, the LPs have the dollars today, but the GPs have the co-investment and they can pursue a new type of LP these days. So Juan, where do you think the power balance lies and what could tip that balance?
Well, I think right now it's clearly with the LPs. Don't underestimate the ability of the GPs to figure out ways to take that back. And I think you alluded to some of the strategies because the LPs need liquidity. And the trade-off of that is cash. For as long as distributions are slow and the fundraising is where it is, the LPs retain that. The LPs need to, as we know, they never get their act together on asking for something in particular because the LPs have different agendas. So they're asking for something. They're asking for co-investment, some of them. You begin to see asking for terms. But by and large, the LPs now control that. And timing is one of the best things they can do. Are they liquid? Are you liquid? Can you close? We've actually been surprised in the past by how quickly, as soon as you start seeing the DPIs go up, and then the reinvestment pressure comes back on and out the window goes all the LP power, right? So I think we are in that point, maybe halfway through that game where the LPs do have a lot of say.
Institutional, private wealth, two sides of the same coin maybe. Why is the growth of the private wealth channel good for our industry and how do we see these two groups of investors interacting maybe to each other's benefit, I would ask?
I think it's reality. So I don't know that there's benefit or disadvantage. I think the reality is that the individual investor has seen very clearly the benefit of this asset class and the benefit that it has brought to the institutional investor. So lots of studies, lots of data showing how the private markets have been a return enhancer. And so if you're the retail investor and you know that reality and you've seen the charts and you've seen the articles and you've seen great things that Hamilton Lane has published, it has you, I think, having the reaction of, well, I want that. Why don't I get to have that? So today you're looking at private wealth channels that's measured in trillions and not small trillions, lots of trillions, that essentially has an exposure of zero to the private markets. And so the notion that that will stay zero or remain zero is flawed. It will not. And so you'll begin to see retail investors' portfolios look more like institutional investors and frankly, and beyond. I think the retail investor will be frankly less focused on illiquidity, duration. These will be retirement assets and they'll be, I think, increasingly comfortable to see their private market allocations rise from zero to 10 to 20 to 30 and beyond. So I think the reality that we're all going to be dealing with is that this will be an asset class that will have both types of investors, both growing, both wanting increasing amounts of exposure, and those that want to provide services to both of those types of investors are going to need to make sure that they have their own infrastructure and capabilities ready and able to deal with the needs and desires of both of those types of investors.
And I would add, in the process of doing that, we as an industry have created better choices. I think you look at the evergreen funds and the number of institutions and family offices are saying, well, we like that. I like shorter duration. I like to be fully paid in. I like to have monthly instead of quarterly. So some of the structures that have been designed specifically to cater to this, as these funds grow in size, are going to be increasingly just tools, investment tools utilized by institutional portfolios because of some of these characteristics. So rather than feeling as we are here, the private market experts at Hamilton Lane, just focused on the arrival of the type of money, you have to recognize that these are pretty interesting structures. The industry has talked about evergreen and permanent capital forever, for decades. And now you have vehicles that are actually achieving part of that, not maybe 100% of that. But I think that's to your point about synergies or mutual benefits to both type of investors. That is clearly one that institutions are increasingly paying attention to.
I echo that. I can't go a board meeting or a client call today without them asking what is going on the private wealth side and what are the structures and how do I get smarter about the structures.
Right.
So I think there's a little bit of fear of the unknown, but but sparking their interest at the same time.
I think that's right. Like, and you know, outside of the U.S., you get asked by in the Mexico breakfast on Monday, you know, how big is it? Because you're thinking, could I put $100 million on that without affecting the overall NAV, et cetera, what's your cash drag? What is so clearly, and we have some parts of the world where some of our institutional clients have already started investing with us using the evergreen product. So it's not a divide we impose. It's a type of client that has generated innovation in the industry and in the offerings.
And then go back to the public markets. There are very large leading franchises that today work and provide services to both institutional and individual. And so there are lots of individual investors with public equity portfolios sitting with an asset management firm. And at that exact same asset management firm, there's a lot of institutional investors with accounts as well. So I think as an industry, we shouldn't be looking at this as either an us versus them or a this or a that. I think this is an and that these things are going to continue to need to coexist because both are going to be important. Both want access to the same thing, which is the great performance that this industry has provided. This industry, we go through all the hue and cry of, oh, more money will come in and that. Relax. We've been an industry that has been growing and performance has not suffered. And that continues to be our reality. And we're still very small as an industry. So if you sort of look at private market capital in terms of dollars raised or transaction volume, and you put that in context of the public markets, and what have we seen recently? A handful of technology companies that have already surpassed, one of those companies has surpassed all of the dollars raised in the private markets over the last year or two. We're tiny, with a lot of room to grow.
So you both oversee the investment teams, and our big market overview comes out very soon, I think next week. What are the big themes this year, and what is the tone you're setting with the investment teams today, and how you're thinking about portfolio construction?
One of the themes is a lot of people spend last year doing nothing. So to invest or not to invest was relatively like considered thoughtful, prudent for a lot of 2023. And there comes a point when one of the themes is get going. A lot of people who did something took by and large credit positions. Private credit has done well. Some started in Q1, some were really catching up in Q4, some are beginning now. Equity allocations were somewhat underweight relative to that. Secondaries has been very active. And so we are saying to our investors, this is a market to be active. This is a market to be tactical, but it's not a market to sit out, to wait for a radical correction of that. And I think there was a lot of sentiment due to the denominator effect and other considerations of doing nothing was a good choice. And one of the themes this year, without unveiling some of the media and the references, is that you got to face that decision, and we are recommending that you get going.
I think our market overviews so often have to deal with myth-busting, something that as a firm we love doing. But the reality continues to be that despite being an industry that is maturing, it's an industry that is largely devoid of data, and it allows for a lot of incorrect assertions. It allows for a lot of, quote, so-called experts who really don't have data to sort of posit very strongly held views that are often flawed and debunked once you actually look at the data. And so I think as someone who has the data, we spend a lot of time trying to just provide data-driven, non-biased analysis of what the industry is and what it isn't.
Sprinkle in a little humor.
And a little bit of that.
It's our MO. We talk a lot about culture around here and how important that is. Obviously, you guys are fully supportive of that. How are you thinking about continuing to encourage this culture of idea generators?
I think both of us frankly view this as a startup. It's a 30 plus year old startup, but it still feels like a startup. If you think about drivers of business, even we go back to the sort of the retail investment space, 6 years ago, that didn't even exist. And today it's a meaningful part of the business, which has provided all kinds of interesting new career paths and growth opportunities for people internally. I think people want to work and join and play on a winning team. Nobody wants to go to work for a company that is sleepy and tired and losing and not growing. So when we talk about why growth is important, it's important for our clients, because scale matters so much. And with that scale, we can do more and access more and get better terms. And all, so scale matters from the client perspective. Scale and growth also matters enormously for the employees as well, because it provides opportunity. And so I think for both Juan and I, we kind of have this startup mindset of that's what we are. There are still new business lines to be created and new geographies to explore. And getting the rest of the team continue to sort of think about change is good, new ideas are great. So you look at the communication channels internally, there's just lots of areas that are focused on what can we do different, better, and get people sort of thinking that way. But the culture overall is huge. We don't manufacture widgets at the end of the day. We are a people business. And so aside from wanting to play on a winning team, you also want to play with people that you enjoy. And so having that culture where there is this sort of teamwork mentality of we're winning and we're doing it with people that we fundamentally enjoy winning with, that's a great combination.
We've also spent a lot of, you know, balance sheet capital, firm resources, thinking about technology and solutions and just overall, you know, looking around the corner in this industry of what's coming. How do you think we'll continue to use our balance sheet capital to push those strategic, you know, objectives forward?
I think it's a luxury to have it. So the fact that we have a balance sheet, I think we use it smartly is a real advantage to the business. But I think we have taken a unique approach when it comes to technology. I think we recognize what we are and what we're not. We're an asset management firm. We have some amazing technologists in-house, but we're fundamentally not a technology business. And so what we've done is we've gone out and found terrific partners where we've then economically aligned ourselves with them by taking ownership stakes in their business. We believe that they can make us better and we in turn can make them better. And so economically, we want to align with them. And so that's what we've been using our balance sheet. We've taken today over 15 positions in different market-leading technology businesses that are solving problems for the industry, solving problems for Hamilton Lane. And we're partnering with them in every sense of the word, trying to propel them forward, trying to propel this industry forward, and trying to propel us forward.
So last question, what are each of you most looking forward to in this new role?
I'm having a blast, and it's only February. So frankly, I'm looking forward to the to my next trip to Australia. It's only the second time this year, to the Investor Day, to the market overview that we're launching. I think there is a cyclicality to the year in what we do and in the markets overall. And I feel like it's the first round of all of that. And I'm very much kind of looking at that wave and enjoying, frankly, first, a lot of firsts. I had the privilege. That was my first trip as a co-CEO to Japan. You would not believe the courtesy that I was afforded by all these meetings, because it was my first trip and they were aware of that. So I'm humbled by that. I'm enjoying that.
I think we're both high energy, intellectually curious people. And if that's what motivates you and inspires you, intellectual curiosity and interacting with people and sort of dealing with change and thinking about how to see around corners, then there's just no greater privilege than to be kind of at the reins of a amazing company with amazing growth prospects, with an amazing team. That is an honor and it's a privilege, but it's exciting in every way, shape, and form.
Thank you, Juan and Eric. This has been very interesting, and I'm glad we got the first exclusive co-interview, I believe.
Thank you, Judy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening in to another episode of Private Markets Made Human. Please stay tuned for our next episode, and don't miss our 2024 market overview, where we dive even further into the trends shaping the private markets industry today.